Right, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Can you hear me? Everybody can hear? You can't hear me. Okay, there we go. It looks like we got to talk right on the mic here, everybody. My name is Peggy Berryhill. I am a member of the Muscogee Nation, and I have been a journalist for a long time, about 45 years. Have been covering, of course, Native issues. And I say, of course, because that's really why I became a journalist. And I'm very happy. Thank you very much, SEJ, for inviting us to have this panel, to talk to the people who are from this land right here that we all call California. And we put together a panel primarily of Native Californians. We wanted you to know people who are nearby in this neighborhood. This is called Environmental Health and Justice and Indigenous Rights and the Environment. And we are going to talk about that. We're going to focus, I'm going to tell you this, we're going to focus first on our California tribes. We have Eric Wilder, who is a former tribal chairman of the Kashaya Pomo. He's also a great artist, a great singer, and an actor. We have Kayleen Sisk, who is chief of the Winnemenwintu, one of our fiercest warriors that I know of and has been all over the world fighting for water and the rights of the salmon and trying to get Shasta Dam to be taken down. And Morningstar Golly is here also. Morningstar is born into activism. She was literally born into the movement. I actually knew her parents long before she even came around. And she has worked with several tribes. Right now you're freelancing, I take it. But most recently was the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Achamawi, known as Pit River. Commonly we call them Pit River. She's also been at the North Dakota, in North Dakota, with the Standing Rock people twice. And we have some wonderful guests from Hawaii we're going to hear from as well. So here's the ground rules. First, we're going to start talking about California, because as much as we all are inspired by what's going on in North Dakota, we want to remember the people right here, the people right here whose land it is that we're all guests on. Then we'll talk about North Dakota, and we'll be joined by our Hawaiian friends who have just become formally recognized, I understand, by the White House. Not as a federally recognized tribe, but recognized in another way. Just out of coincidence, probably not out of coincidence, just on Thursday, I believe it was, the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., brought out to display one of the 18 unratified treaties with the tribes here in California. Just a brief synopsis, in case you don't know about the tribes here in California, by the time what we know as the United States got here, there were no more treaty making. There were 18 treaties, but they were not ratified, and the official policy was legal genocide. And the California government and the U.S. Congress passed, I think it was $3 million, something like that, to eradicate these people. So they wouldn't be here if they would have won. These people would not be here, but they're here. And their ancestors kept them strong, and they're still here. So we're very happy to present them. So if you have a question, we're going to ask you to repeat it because we're recording this, and we want to share this on the SEJ site and a lot of Native radio stations. We have 68 Native radio stations in the United States are interested in hearing about this panel as well. So Eric Wilder, I'm going to start with Eric. Eric, tell us about the Kashaya and a little bit about the tribe.
Hey, in my Iwa, Eric Wilder, Ekishichima, Kashaya Pomonopotol Bakeya, Winama Bakeyachma Bakeya. I am Eric Wilder. I'm from the Kashaya Pomo people. I am from the people from the top of the land. I have served with my tribe two terms as tribal secretary and two terms as tribal chairman. And as growing up as a young boy in my tribe, one of the things that I was taught by my grandmother, Essie Parrish, who is a world-famous spiritual leader for the Kashaya people, she helped establish a written language and help create a written language for our people and help record all of our stories and record it down, all of our ceremonies on video. And part of that was to, and the main reason, she would say, is to preserve that so that our kids could know in the generations going forward, would know who they are, would not forget who they are. They can go to the universities, go to other people that would be able to, they would be able to find out who they are and not be lost. And one of the things that we were taught was to respect the creation. And what do I mean by that? I mean that our earth, our land, our air, our water, our the animals and the plants, the creatures in the ocean, all of it. In our history, we were told that we were all animals at one time, and we all spoke the same language. And then at one point, our people then became people, and some of the animals stayed the animals. But what I was taught was our language, our history, our plant uses, and to respect all the different living things, and taught about all of the creation. My grandmother would say to me that the water, especially the water, was the most important creation ever made by the Creator on this earth. Without the water, everything would cease to function. It would fail. Without the water, your blood would fail. Without the water, the plants would fail. Without the water, the animals would fail. So she said, this is a great resource that we must take care of, and we always respect it. And so whenever we gather from the ocean, whenever we gather from the land, we hold a ceremony for that. We have to follow a law of reciprocity, and that was one of our main laws. And that we give. That's why we have our ceremonies. That's why we have our dancing. That's why we do our prayers, because we sacrifice and we give in order for the land to provide for us. That is one of the main laws of our Creator. And so so that's what I do, as establish programs for our tribe to teach that. And currently as an artist, then I also work for the Manchester Pomo as a ocean and coastal steward for them, and I'm teaching other tribes cultural resource directors and leaders on techniques on how to monitor, how to protect sites, and teach some of the Creator's laws that a lot of tribes have forgotten, or help them remember some of the things that they have partial records of. And then together we're forming together to help fight all of these environmental issues to take care of our earth.
Eric, what are some of the environmental issues that the Pomo, and by the way, this tribe is in Mendocino County, the southern tip of Mendocino County, Stewart's Point Rancheria, and the rancheria is 40 acres?
It was 40 acres, and then we just acquired about 5 years ago, I want to say like almost 650 acres, and then just earlier this year we finalized another coastal property for, I think, almost 900 acres.
I think I see Eric every week at the hardware store buying bags of soil and reclaiming land that way. Eric, in terms of your relationship when you were a tribal chairman, why don't you explain a little bit about the role vis-a-vis the federal government? Because we're going to talk to Kayleen in a moment, who is not federally recognized or state recognized. What are some of the things for the audience who might not know what it's like to have that, quote, government-to-government relationship?
That's a great question. I can't imagine what it's like for the Chairwoman Sisk here to deal with the federal government not having that status, because it's hard. It's a hard thing dealing with the federal government being federally recognized. Trying to get something done with the federal government is, especially the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it's a hard thing because you cannot get a direct answer from them. That was a frustrating thing for me as tribal chairman. They will refuse and refuse to give you something in writing, but it's the total opposite. When they want something, they want it in writing, but they will hardly ever give you something in writing, so that they have deniability. And I'm not saying that because this is fact, and I have friends, Native friends, that have worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and have said that is what they're told to do, to delay giving tribes any answer. And so to get things done, to get things backing from the federal government on such issues as environmental protection, it's a hard political game, that's the game you have to play. And as a tribal leader, it's really frustrating to try to tell your tribal people that we still haven't an answer for you. We're still trying to get us access to land that we own now. People are asking whether we can gather there, and I'm asking whether we can gather there by our new tribal chairman. He says, well, according to the law that's been set for the coast, it says in there that we can have access, but Fish and Game is saying no, we can't. And then we have lawyers. We're speaking with the state and federal government to try to see what the real language of that is. And so it's frustrating for our people who do gather and try to teach our techniques for gathering to protect the coast. It's a big fight. It is. And trying to teach, and I'll tell you a story. I don't want to take up all the time. Okay, really quickly, I'm going to just talk about the Marine Life Protection Act. The Marine Life Protection Act was brought forward to protect the resources because they were being depleted on our coast. As a tribal chairman at the time, all the tribes were brought together in our area at Dry Creek Rancheria, and we were asked to identify areas that we were thought of significance, where we are significant for our tribe, whether it's gathering or a sacred area or a village. So we identified that. All of our tribal people identified those places, but I refused. And I said, as a coastal tribe, I said, I'm going to just put this in a way that maybe you could understand. I said, you're asking me to identify which areas on this coast because you're going to close down most of it, but supposedly give us access to certain areas still that we've been traditionally gathering. I said, you guys should have come to us at the beginning of this to help plan this. And I said, this is at the very end of this whole process. And I said, what if I came to you and said, we're going to take your body parts, and I want you to tell me what parts you can live without. I said, we're the stewards of this coast. Manchester, in our area, Kashaya, Great Narancheria, all of our people in that Sonoma, Mendocino County area, we're the stewards of this coast, and we still try to be. And I said, you're trying to tell us which areas are important, which areas are not. I said, this whole coast is important to us. And I said, I won't say one area is more important than the other because it's all important. And in the end, we weren't given access to any area. And they'll deny that because they did give us access to one area, but we had to fight for that. And still, we can't get in there unless we get permission from the landowner that access area is. And we still seldom get permission to go in there. But we continue that fight, and we will continue that fight to protect it.
Thank you, Eric, and you can ask more questions of Eric. Next, I want to introduce you to another person that I've admired for decades, Chief Kayleen Sisk. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring both Eric and Kayleen is together is because they both come from families where they had grandmothers who were the last healers of their tribes. They both have maintained their languages. They both maintain the history and embody who they are as their different tribes are. However, in where Kayleen is from, the Shasta Dam came in, and they dammed up, put the dam up, and a lot of the bottom land is where a lot of her people lived. And so they lost it, just like in North Dakota, very similar. These dams have done that all over the country. But she has continued, is very strong. She is not federally recognized. She is not state recognized. But she has never stopped fighting for, like Eric, the water, the salmon, and the environment. And a very, very strong leader. She's been to the UN. She's been all over the world. We're very, very proud of her. And there's a wonderful film that came out recently, a documentary called Dancing Salmon Home. If you get a chance to see that, it's a wonderful story of Kayleen, the Maori, and the salmon. Kayleen, please.
Hestem Chalit, Ukowin Alawi, Winamam Wintu, Waiwakat, Okwanat, Tlahit. I'm from the mountain of Mount Shasta, and my people are on the watershed of the Winamam Waiwakat. You know, there's so many things that could be said in so little time to say these things, and I understand that you're all journalists, right? You're people who write about issues and about events and about fights that are going on. And you know, we've been dealing with journalists for a long time and trying to get a real reflection from a perspective that is not included in your journalist schools. And so, like Eric, you know, I come from a long line of healers and leaders of our people. And in fact, as he was talking, I was thinking, you know, Essie Parrish and Jenny Marufo and Raymond Stone and Jimmy James and Florence Jones all knew and worked with each other up and down the state. That, you know, every place that Grams traveled, I traveled many times with her. And we used to do that. We don't do that anymore, that federal recognition came in. We don't do that anymore. That a separation of rights has divided us. We don't take care of each other anymore in that same way. You know, the objectives, one of the things I learned about journalism is that you're supposed to remain objective when you're writing a piece. And the problem with that, as I tell my journalist friends who are trying to write down the things and issues that we're fighting, is that if you knew the culture, then you could remain objective. But if you don't know what you're looking at, you don't know how to interpret, you don't know how to state it, then it's wrong of you to write of it. You know, when we go back and we look at the documentations about our Bothless Chonas, our women's coming of age ceremony, and in there, the writer that wrote down that event that they saw, they document that at some point in time that the old women beat the young girl with sticks. And that's because they don't know what they're looking at. At that point in time, the young women brush her off with these willow sticks, hazel sticks, that gives her the blessings of the plants. It's not a beating. And so I don't agree, you know, somewhere along the line, you guys need to address that issue because it's it leaves us in a position of defending those issues that were written because in your world that becomes you know the authority. whatever is documented and whatever is written becomes stuck in time. And just like the federal recognition issues, we should have never, if California ever agreed with any kind of federal recognition process, because we already had the California claims case. We already have all of us documented as being here before 1850 when it became a state. And now they're asking us to do it again. We already did it. And my gram said, we're not going to apply. They put out an application process. What an insult. After all that that state has done to us, to make us apply to be who we are. And who are they to approve it? That's what she says. Is it the High Council of the Winnemem Wintu people that's going to judge whether or not you're Winnemem enough still? And so we have never made application for that. However, we are watching as hundreds of other tribes in California, as 90% of the California people are left off of the list of the recognition blessings. And those tribes, since 1980, no tribes in California have been recognized in the process. They're all in ready status. They're all defending their application. They all stand solid. They've all submitted like tons of information documenting their existence here. And then the Talawa was denied their application for recognition. And I look at them as much like us. You know, they're in their own homeland. They sing their songs. They do their dances. They do their prayers. They speak their language, all of that. And they were denied. And at that denial, it's like, we need to throw that process out. It does not work. And but we're not there as Indian people. We've been single put into these little peg holes now, where we don't even visit with each other anymore the way that the elders did before. We would travel up and down the state from up in Kurok all the way down to Raymondstone in the San Diego area. But we don't do that anymore. We don't have time for that anymore. Something happened. So the, we think, like he says, you know, getting a straight answer from the BIA. It's like the BIA doesn't really help. I mean, people say, well, do you want to be recognized? And so what exactly does that mean? Is it, you know, because what I see recognized tribes doing, we're doing the same thing, or we're even doing better than that. You know, because we're still fighting the federal government on all levels, but we have eliminated the BIA by being unrecognized. They have no say over us. They have no input over us. And so we deal directly with federal government, Forest Service, BOR, BLM, you know, directly. And so we don't have to have the BIA, you know, skirting around and making deals on our behalf. That the struggle is hard and it's long. And the hope there is a part of the health issues of all the California people. California Indians in particular are subjected to the water issues that have arisen for GMO farming in the desert as opposed to our salmon on the river. So the only thing that I could say about the recognition issues is that, you know, I watched my tribes here and the ones in the Southwest fight for the San Francisco Peaks over the sacredness of that place. And even those strong, recognized, some wealthy tribes could not protect that mountain from that ski lodge. And so I'm thinking, it's like federal recognition would be meaningful to me if it helped me protect my sacred places, if it helped me to do these things. And the way that it works with the health, language, education, Indian child welfare, that are acts of Congress that we have no access to, is discriminatory treatment. Because even if we're unrecognized, we should have a set of rights. And there are none. That's why we go to the UN. That's why we're going to other indigenous women in the world to say discriminatory treatment that prevents us from utilizing the drip in our distinctive way of life has to stop. And even if it's the richest country in the world, the U.S. government, somehow it has to be brought to the people. Because, you know, no one should be saying there's unrecognized people in California or anywhere. It's like there is a group growing at the UN called Unrecognized Unrepresented Peoples of the World. And one of the things that other people in other worlds ask me, who represents you in your Congress? Who represents you in your state? Because they sit in Parliament, even in third world countries, they sit in Parliament and represent the indigenous people's issues. Who in this Congress, who in this government represents our issues? When they're talking about the Shasta Dam raise, who in the federal government, in Dianne Feinstein's office and in that level, represents the indigenous issues that we're going to face? Because we already survived that one time. But the environmental impact reports doesn't report the conditions that we will be left in. How many of us will be able to survive as Winnemem Wintu again, should that be done? You know, and we are fighting for a salmon, and that's a whole other governmental clash that's happening. We're on a salmon run right now. We're on Facebook run for salmon, and we're heading there after this to complete our run from the Bay Area, our stand against the tunnels, because of the fish issues, and all the way up the river to McLeod River. But these are things that come in prayer. This is not a protest. This is a way of protecting and answering a prayer that is put down. And we don't need any approvals from anybody to do that, because it's between us and the Maker. You know, and that's how we're kind of made, and that's how I kind of want us to stay. You know, to be a Winnemem Wintu, you have to believe your religion is Winnemem Wintu. You can't belong to any other churches because it's just too much work. And you have to learn the songs of the Winnemem Wintu to sing them at those places, or no one will. And you have to dance that way because no one else is going to dance for you if you don't dance. And so if we're going to survive as Winnemem Wintu, we have to put those values in our children. And the schools can't do it. And the colleges can't do it, and the jobs can't do it. We have to do it, you know. And so there's a lot of work trying to remain tribal and traditional and true to our sacred grounds and our sacred places. And so that's the job.
Kayleen, I hate to do this.
Oh, I'm done.
I've got to be the timekeeper here, and I think that it, you know, that's a great way to have to in this portion. And as a timekeeper, I have to say we're going to be kicked out of here at noon exactly, and it's now 11:17. So Morning Star, and then we do want to talk to Hawaiians, and you're all journalists. I know some of you are probably very interested in the Dakota Access Pipeline as well, but we do want to talk about California. So Morning Star, I'm going to have to ask you to be brief about your tribe, but then we, because we also want to introduce our Hawaiian guests. So we're going to have to move through this a little quickly, but there are many things that we want to talk to you as journalists and how to elevate the conversation. So Morning Star Gali, take it away.
Morning Star Gali, Chumawi Band of Pitt River. Should introduce myself. Morning Star Gali, Ilakatige Chi'i, Ma'a Chumawi Ischi'i. This is my daughter, Ha'ali, with us, and she's turning 3 tomorrow, so not wanting to leave my lap today. So it's always an honor to be on a panel here next to Kellen, and we work a lot together. You know, there's this distinction that's been made in terms of federally recognized versus unrecognized. Or unfederally recognized, but for my tribe specifically, and Kelly mentioned, you know, the battle with our tribe fighting for federal recognition. We're 11 autonomous bands, culturally autonomous, within what's considered the 100-mile square. There's four counties that reside within our ancestral territories, and we're two bands of Ojibwe and Otsegewi peoples. And so when you come to the table as two distinct tribes and 11 bands, it can be very slow going in terms of being able to, and that was intentional, right? That was intentional in even the fact that we were recognized and our application being approved, because they realized at the time in terms of our tribes coming together that it would be difficult to have, you know, those common goals and agreements, even though we're neighboring tribes. And so I worked for 4.5 years for my tribe as the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer. I recently left that position, and I was at Standing Rock this past week, spent a week there, and just missed our relatives. We were actually had, and I was in Hawaii and had an action in Waikiki while you entered in. And so that was just powerful in knowing that that welcoming was taking place. And I just want to speak to you as atrocious as it is of what's taking place at Standing Rock in terms of the desecration of burials, as atrocious as it is there in terms of the lack of consultation with the tribes for the pipeline to be built, that it's not uncommon, that it's actually taking place all over the country, and in terms of the violations of rights, the violations with tribes. And so we see that with our neighbors, the Winnemem-Wintu, with the Shasta Dam raise. We see that within our homeland, we're fighting Calpine Energy Corporation, along with the Bureau of Land Management and U.S. Forest Service, to protect our sacred lake of the Medicine Lake Highlands, which Calpine has proposed a geothermal energy project that that will build a power plant within our sacred home, within our sacred Highlands area. And so I think that's really important to note. I know there's a lot of writing that's taking place, a lot of environmental pieces that are being written about Standing Rock, but it's happening right here within our own homes. And so I was there for a week working on a national sacred sites policy, because we recognize that what's happening, you know, we can't continue to allow this to occur. It has been occurring. And so, in support of tribes that do not have the federal recognition status, I think it's also important to note that it's, I believe, 1/3 of tribes within California that, are applying or in the process of applying for federal recognition. And so you're talking about one third of Native peoples here, that are continuously fighting with a lack of resources. And that's really what it comes down to with our sacred place protection, with the San Francisco Peaks that was mentioned, a mountain that's holy to 13 tribes within the Southwest, one of the largest tribes in the country, the Navajo Nation, and they were not able to stop it. They were not able to stop the sewage waste effluent from being piped up from the city of Flagstaff and used in an artificial snowmaking process so that people can go and ski on a mountain with fake snow on it within the middle of Arizona, within the northern part of Arizona, because that's necessary, right? That's necessary versus a tribe that believes that's centered beliefs are that the Kachinos make snow on that mountain, that there is no other place that they can go. And so I think that's really important to note is the resource extraction that is taking place all over the country. It's taking place here in California. And so there's this effort now in terms of the joint MOUs that just came out 2 weeks ago in support of Standing Rock and recognizing that there is pressure being applied. And they said, and it is right now with this administration, with the Obama administration, where they admitted that they did, you know, basically screw up in terms of the issue with the San Francisco Peaks after the fact, but that this needs to stop occurring and that we really need to address it, and we need to address how it's affecting all tribal nations, and that includes tribes that do not have the federal recognition status.
Well, Morningstar, thank you so much. I'm sorry to have to cut it a little short. I want to bring our Native Hawaiian friends up here to the mic. And while they're coming up, I want you as journalists to think about some of the things you've heard about. And one of the things that Morningstar said, that a lot of the actions are intentional. I think it's time, as journalists, to elevate the conversation about Native people and not as victims of history, but to look at them as intellectual peers. Look at what they're fighting against, that these are people who are scientists. These are people who understand, who have practiced environmental protection and food sovereignty for generations. So let's elevate the conversation and not just talk about victims of history or treaties or non-treaties, but intellectual peers. The act that is going on by Dave Archambault and his tribe is intentional. It is not an accident. It's not something they backed into a lawsuit. They are doing something to elevate all of us. And I think the other thing is looking at how, also like how Morningstar says, Standing Rock is right here at home. Very important to recognize, whatever state you're from, there are Native people in your own backyard. And we do support Dave Archambault and Standing Rock. But the Native people right in your own backyards also need recognition because we don't know their histories. Okay, next. Thank you.
Aloha mai kakou. O mauna awa kea tu mauna. O kohakohau a me waikoloa tu mau kahawai. O pu'ukapu mai te moku o Hawaii moku o ke ave tu o aina. I hanau ia me ke aloha nui i ka piko o ke aloha, i ka piko o ka mauna awa kea. A kākou e holomu ai e kūnei ki e manawa i kukia i mauna. My name is Pua Case, and I'm standing. I'm going to ask you to hear our words. We're going to speak of something very important in a few moments. So I'm going to leave out some very necessary information when you only have a few minutes. That happens, and you know that as journalists, you get one or two quotes from us, and it's not the picture, not the real picture. And when we leave, we say, we should have said that. They didn't get the real picture. So I'm purposely saying that right now. I have a few minutes to tell you about what's going on in Hawaii and the alliance, and it's going to be a fragmented piece. So if you, if it touches your heart, please come and see me or look for me on Sacred Facebook, Pua Case. You can find me there. And I'm thanking this panel. Thank you so much, because we're here as visitors and relatives, and we recognize you as the ancestral peoples of this place, your kupuna, your elders, and you sitting here today, and we thank you. We thank you, and we recognize you, and we ask permission to be here. And if I had a longer moment, we would have chanted that permission in, because we believe in that permission is essential, is the way of our elders, to not walk into a place without asking permission. It is protocol for us as a Native people, so I apologize that we are just merely asking this, and I thank you for giving us a few moments. We come from the island of Hawaii. We are known here at this moment as the Mauna Kea Ohana. We are protectors of our sacred mountain, Mauna Awa Kea, also known as Mauna Kea. It is the highest mountain in the world from the seafloor. And there are 13 telescopes on that mountain. In 1968, there was a permit for one small little structure on the mountain. And through every means possible, most of the time without us knowing, over the years, 13 are now standing on that mountain. Being a Mauna Kea Ohana protector means that we are standing and protecting our mountain from the building of an 18-story, 30-meter telescope. If approved, it would be the highest building on the mountain on anywhere in Hawaii Island, which is against the law. There is no 18-story building to be allowed anywhere on Moku'u Ke'awe. And so what has happened, journalists, our friends, you, our friends here today who are listening, is that there comes a time when a people, and in this case a native people, who would ever have thought that the natives of Hawaii would start a movement, would stand on a mountain and link arms against armed officers? Would you ever have thought that the place of tourism, known to be paradise around the world, that a native people would rise and say, not this time. This one is the one too big, the one too many that will change everything for us. If you build this on our mountain, our most sacred mountain, where we are still connected to the ancestral deities, wisdom, where we have made a promise to take care of this place from the mountain to the sea, then you may as well just take everything. If you can do that to us five countries, including this country and India and Japan and Canada, and China, if you do this, you may as well take everything. So we as mothers and fathers, we as babies and grandparents, we have risen to stand on our mountain. We have held off, even though approved, this 30-meter telescope since 2011. And we are still standing. In the Supreme Court, we won the right to start over. So now we are in our second contested case, which begins on October 11th, and we are parties in that case. And why would we stand? Why would we do that? It's not about science versus culture, as journalists have made it appear, as the media has painted that picture. It's not about that. We are people who still have traditional ways. We have songs, we have chants, we have life ways. We have water on that mountain. We have the largest aquifer on that mountain that would be built on. And it seems right now that all of us are standing for water as Native people. And I don't understand why we don't have more support from the masses of people. Because we are not only standing for Native people, like only we're going to be affected if our water aquifers are impacted. We're standing for all people. But somehow, we're always standing alone. And we believe, we truly believe, that it is a responsibility and a privilege, because we're not nearsighted, we're farsighted. We're standing for not just us, but seven generations of our own people and for all people. So how is it that we are here today by way of Standing Rock? There are alliances being made, beautiful, positive alliances being made from a small little homeland in Hawaii to Standing Rock, to Apache Oak Flat, to Winnemem-Wintu, all around the world. And it's come to this where we must. We have no choice but to stand. And why are we here? We're here because those from Standing Rock prayed for us, stood with us on our own mountain, as the Winnemem-Wintu did, flew to Hawaii and stood with us. And now it is our turn. It is our turn to be here. And if you are all journalists, the word that I hear and the word that I say that is detrimental to all of us is media blackout. There's no good media on any of us. It has taken us years in Hawaii to have one positive newspaper article. One. When we are standing for everyone's water. When I was in Standing Rock, I felt like I was in a Thunderheart movie. How many of you have seen that movie, Thunderheart, with Val Kilmer? I hope you haven't. If you haven't, go watch it, and I'll tell you why. I felt like that was a movie that was from the 70s, I think, in the AIM movement. And it was really based on Leonard Peltier, who I hope has freedom before he passes from this earth. I hope his freedom is not after he passes from this earth. I felt like I was back in that time period when we had to go through checkpoints, National Guard, and we had to stand facing rows of armed police officers with their helmets on the first day there. And we still stood. Of course, we have no choice because we're standing for the water, for all people. I felt that. And I've heard the word media blackout over and over and over again. And Facebook was the way that we got information. Journalists, we are asking you. I'm not above begging you. I'll go on my knees if I have to. We need our stories told accurately. We need to be recognized as honorable people. We are not trying to stop progress. We are trying our best to protect what is desecration, construction, and destruction of sacred places, special places, places we all need, not just us as Native people. Our mountains are calling us to stand. Their voices are in our hearts. Our mountains speak to one another, and they are speaking loud and clear. Do something before it's too late. And if it is us as the Native people who are connected genealogically to these places that have to rise and stand, I hope that we don't have to continue to stand alone. And if the best you can do, if you can't stand with us against a loaded gun, like my daughter has, like my niece has, and gotten arrested, both of them, two beautiful young women, get arrested on a mountain for praying after 10 o'clock. Praying on a mountain. If you can't do that, maybe you can just write about us in a good way, in a deep way. And may your hearts guide your pens and your keypads and tell our story so that the next seven generation know that their grandparents stood and stood proud and did the best we could. And I thank you for hearing me, and I say these things in a good way. Thank you.
Thank you so much, our honored guests here. All right, we're down to about the last 20 minutes, and I want to allow you time to ask questions. I need you to identify yourself. Pua, could you say and spell your name for us? Thank you so much. So I'm going to give you time as journalist. I need you to identify yourself. Give me a moment to repeat the question because this is being recorded, and we want to make sure everybody gets as many of you get a chance to answer. Ask a question. Okay, the question is from Sarah Como from Oklahoma, a journalist who is asking for advice to non-Native people. How do you cover Native issues? And I believe you also used the term protest. Is that correct? Okay. It looks like Kayleen is going to answer first.
Yeah, I have a short answer for you. And one of them is that after all this time and all of the events that are taking place. We refer to ourselves as protectors, not protesters. But if you come in asking for the protesters, then you're looking for the activists and not the protectors, because we come from a different stance of why we're doing this. Like this run from the Bay Area to there, it's to protect this whole water system. This is the Standing Rock. This water fix that governor's tossing out there, that's the Standing Rock, and everybody's sleeping. You know, but come in with protectors.
I would ask some of you, especially those of you, you know, gone to J school, everybody talks about objectivity and bias. Who made those rules? Whose determination was it what objectivity is? Whose determination was what bias was and how you covered issues? When I worked at NPR many, many years ago, we, the people of color, weren't allowed on the news floor. And I went down to the news floor one day and I talked to the news director, and he told me very clearly, this is quite a while ago because you'll see some things have changed. He said, well, Peggy, the day will never come when women can cover women issues, when black people can cover black issues, when native people can cover native issues. So I said to him, then why do you have white men covering Congress? He walked away from me. He never responded to that. So, yes, J School has a lot of lessons for you. Facts are important, triple-checking your facts. But also, as I was saying, let's talk about elevating this conversation. Eric, do you have any response to that, or Morningstar?
I'm sorry. I do, just in that. So we followed very closely the Malhar refuge, the wildlife refuge, earlier in the year. And it's very interesting how they were given a platform and they were armed, right? And it was on every national news channel, international news channel. And so, being out at Standing Rock and just the very limited news coverage, the only time that it's been covered by CNN or any of those outlets is you know, framing it in a way that the protectors on the ground, that they had weapons, and, you know, that it turned into a violent clash where really it was, I mean, there is a very militarized presence there, and unless you're there, I think that's very difficult to understand. Reservations, many reservations were created as prison camps, and so now the fact that they're trying to make it all look very nice and orderly, and that they have the National Guard that has a blockade up, you know, that has to warn people driving through, warn vehicles that there are people out on the road. You know, there's helicopters flying overhead, there's drones overhead. We can't go over and make prayer offerings without having this interference by this militarized presence. And so I think that's really important to note, just the contrast, the contradiction between the fact that, you know, they were essentially given the militia, you know, standoff was given this huge media platform, was able to say whatever they wanted at the time. And, you know, in just in terms of assisting with some grassroots media support, CNN told us, oh, we'll be there in October to go cover, you know, the issue. And so we're like, oh, we'll wait a couple of weeks. That's, you know, that's nice of making that offer. And so I think, you know, just really, that unbiased viewpoint, but also really noting that that is what's happening on the ground there, that there's militarized police, there's a very strong militarized presence there at the sites, at the camps.
Thank you, Morningstar. Any other questions? No questions. Oh, wait, I was way in the back. You were first. Thank you. So I'm going to repeat the question, paraphrase a little bit. Melissa McCreese, was that it? Milcrease from Montana, talking about this question of objectivity and also of trust on both sides, or lack of trust on both sides, the wariness of Native people and the wariness of non-Native people. How do we overcome that wariness of being able to trust each other and to, I guess, with the result would be the what both sides would feel is a more honest story. Was that, paraphrase it? Okay, anybody else?
Eric Wilder, Kashaya Pomo, former tribal chairman. That's a good question. I would say to any journalists that are non-Native people, you have to understand our history. You have to understand the treatment that we have gone through as a people, the promises we were made that were not kept, and that still continues today. But what you need to understand and what a lot of people fail to understand, and this is what I try to teach other cultural resource people, is that you have to understand that to be able to protect the land, to be able to try to teach people about the importance of the water, of the land, of the creatures on the land, of our resources, you have to understand that you, as a person from whatever tribe you're from, you have been here for thousands of years on this land, and you are also a part of that. You're not just setting aside and saying, oh, look at these plants and these animals, we need to protect it. You have to be protected. You're part of that. You speak a language that you can talk to these plants. You can talk to these, to the land. You can talk to the animals. You still have that ability to do that. They speak the same language. They still recognize you. And we have that responsibility as a people to try to take care of. It's like if somebody was attacked in your family, you're going to get upset about that, and you're going to try to protect them and keep them safe. That's what we're doing. That's what we're doing to try to protect our salmon and trying to protect our ocean, trying to protect our animals, all of these resources that people see as resources. These are our brothers and sisters, and they all have spirits, and we're trying to protect them, our family, and we're a part of that. So if you're going to come to, you understand that history, and then also come as in a respectful way and be honest and say, I am a reporter from this organization, and I understand. I don't understand. I don't understand your history. I want to learn. Teach me. Teach me. And then I would like a dialogue in order to put your words out there, to put your concerns out there for the world to hear. And then also be careful on those words, because us, when we speak out, when we're standing up for our brothers and sisters, we get labeled as activists. An activist is a negative word and a law all over the world when it comes to that. I love that word, protectors. That's what we are. And they protect us. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but, definitely come in a respectful way.
Question here.
Could I add one thing to that?
Sure.
Is that we need to be included in your educational field. You need to have some, not just ethnic study or a requirement to address some of the world issues, because apparently the United States has not addressed its own tribal issues here, so that there are people who are coming out of these school systems with knowledge about the state's indigenous peoples, enough to feel like they have information enough to go forward with it. I mean, it's just like we disappear until the fourth grade, and we're primitive, and then we re-enter at 10th grade in world history, or American history, and then we disappear again. Now it comes back. I think they include the AIM movement in the 70s, some activism stuff, and then we disappear again, and unless you do some college work. And so I think that getting comfortable with each other, because we've been lied to so much, and because we're in efforts that are blocking or are perceived as blocking academic freedom or academic rights or movement and progress ahead, that people get stuck right there. But we see it as we have not done anything for a long time. We are at the tipping edge of climate. We see, because we are not in these artificial environments where you don't see how cold it is, you don't see how hot it is, you don't see how much it's not raining or raining in the right part, and you don't see the number of fish that are coming back or not coming back. But we do, because we're from here 6,000 years, and we have an obligation to talk about that, not on a capitalistic level, but on a success and environmental and survival level. And so we're at that point where indigenous peoples around the world can't wait for science to catch up with what needs to be done to save Mother Earth.
I have to be the timekeeper again here. We've got 10 minutes before we have to leave the room. I just wanted to add, I really do think that the time has come that the indigenous, looking at indigenous people on an intellectual level and the future of technology, have a union together, that it can happen once we begin to be recognized on that same level. One of my favorite quotes from an Ecuadorian Indian woman who went to North Dakota, she said, "We as indigenous people represent 4% of the Earth's population, but we're responsible for protecting 80% of the world's resources." That's a serious covenant that indigenous people have, no matter where they are. Okay, ma'am, your question. Okay, Maureen from Earth Island?
Journal,
Earth Island Journal. So your question is to the people that have either been to North Dakota about the issue, how do they feel about everyone coming together?
Yes, because there is the from what I'm hearing from reports out of there, and also because like a global recognition movement's happening.
Okay, so let me try and so we can use our time here. So the question is, if this is a global indigenous moment, and how are people feeling about that? Puta, would you like to respond to that? I know you're sitting over there, but... I need you to talk on the mic.
Okay.
We want you on the microphone. We want you heard.
What I saw with Mauna Kea, I feel this being mirrored at Standing Rock. Standing Rock is our Mauna Kea. So I can speak from that perspective. What we did on Mauna Kea was begin to unify as a people. When I say unify, I mean come together for the greater good of all things and work it out in a movement to do something more than we ever thought possible. And what I'm seeing is that we are collectively, whether it's Standing Rock or anywhere else, we are braver than our fear. We are forming alliances together because we have to, and also because we want to. And what I see is that when we leave these places, if we go and support each other, like we're here to support Run for Salmon right now, is that we're all stronger in our own homelands. It's like we gather ourselves at these different special places that we have the privilege of gathering at, and we gather strength, and the Creator sees us and recognizes us and says, because you have done this for one another, when you go back, you will be stronger, you will be braver, you will have wisdom that you didn't have before. You will have knowledge, and you will have relatives that support you from other places in the world that you never thought you would have. And I've seen that every place that we have been. And when I go back from this 2-week run that we are doing right now to bring the salmon home from Aotearoa, New Zealand, where the Maoris are just waiting to return your salmon to you, people here of California. After this experience of being with the Winnemem Wintu and their tribal relatives and Standing Rock, and then we go to Washington, D.C., and we end in New York at Indigenous Day because we recognize this alliance between one another, and we recognize that we will strengthen one another. We will be changed forever. And if we have to stand on our mountain again, armed against armed officers, and we are linking arms, we will stand stronger because of these moments. So yes, this alliance is what's forming, and it's necessary for the earth, and it's necessary for all of us. So thank you.
Thank you. Morningstar, could you address that too? I also, Pericase, thank you for using the word alliance as opposed to movement. Thank you. And Morningstar, sure. Could you also address, I mean, look at how young you are.
And
she did used to, we all used to be younger, but you know, you've been raised in this, and there's a lot of young people that we're now seeing who are supporting this. So what is your response?
Sure, and I want to speak specifically to California, because I think that, you know, in this opportunity to address all of you, there's a constant invisibility, right, that we're fighting here in California, that we don't have the stereotypical, you know, planes of what people think a Native person, you know, looks like or acts like. And so when we're speaking to the salmon here and protecting the salmon for us are what the buffalo are to the plains tribes. And so I think that's really important to stress that, you know, with the dams that were put on the rivers, with, you know, the intentional, this was our lifeway for our people, that we had, in my band, we had salmon camps, and we had, you know, fish drying all over in the area where the waterfalls are, where the falls of what's now Fall River Mills. And so that was our sustenance, that was our way of life. And so when they blocked the salmon from coming upriver, now we see the effects of that. We see the health effects. We see the effects of the internalized effects of us within, you know, our own families and our own tribes. And so I think that's really, you know, important to stress that here in California, there's an issue of visibility that we're constantly facing. And yes, of course, Standing Rock is amazing. And, you know, to go there, you know that you're a part of something that's so much bigger than any of us. And we are gathering strength to bring to our homes, and we are fighting these issues within our own homelands and questioning, you know, that issue of there's a big California presence at Standing Rock right now. And so how is it that we come together, you know, as tribes, as we come back and continue to form those alliances and talk to one another? I had friends there that I was working on the sacred site strategies and sacred place strategies that we haven't met face to face in 10 years. And it's like, you know, there's all these amazing people here and amazing minds. And so utilizing that opportunity to come together and be able to be in that connection with one another is really an amazing thing. You know that it is fulfilling this vision and this prophecy of the leaders and of the medicine people of these times that prophesized of the peoples coming together. And so I just wanted to comment on that. And in my tribe, we've lost a number of elders lately, very prominent elders. We've lost a number of council people even. And so to have this here, to have people, like-minded people, traditional people that are fighting for the water and fighting for the salmon and fighting for our future generations here. It's an honor again to sit here, and it's beautiful to be a part of this all together.
Thank you. Okay, we actually only have 1 minute left. Any burning question? Any last question? Okay, it's yours. Okay, Mary Catherine O'Connor, putting me on the spot. As journalists, what sources should we be reading? Well, you know, Indian Country Today is a great source. Indians.com is another one. Oh, boy, I'm trying to think of, there are so many, Trahant Reports, Mark Trahant Reports is another very good one. Listening to Native America Calling is another very good source. Anybody else on the panel? I'm sure there are some probably Native Hawaiian resources we don't know about. There's a lot of scholarly work that's done, so I can't, you know, at so many universities. But those are the American Indian Science and Engineering magazine is another good source. I don't recommend the New York Times. News from Native California. Thank you, Eric. Wonderful resource, Malcolm Margolin and his crew. Boy, those are the only few that are jumping out at me. I'm sure there could be more, but if those aren't on your list, those are excellent sources.
There's a couple of individual writers.
Go ahead, you can use them.
Over the years, we get writers that are fairly good about the information and stuff. But for the events for the Winnemem Wintu tribe, it's Dan Bacher with the whole water fix in California, and covering as much as he can about what the tribe is doing. But also Mark Dadigan, from a perspective that writers don't usually take, and a lot of times it doesn't get published in the larger journal areas, but it does get published in Native California and News from Native California. So those are two people who, you know, that we have learned over the years, and less skeptical. I think that's one of the tactics too, is like, get yourself to be known. Who are you?
Excellent.
What do you
excellent
want?
Excellent advice. I think that's going to have to be the last word, because they told me I have to end on time. I have to tell you all go to eat lunch. But just a few takeaways. I hope some of your takeaways are that you are to understand that these people should be looked as intellectual peers, that there it could be a good future if we all start, you know, working together and listening together. A couple of key words to no longer use: no longer protesters. I think alliance is better than movement. Traditionally, tribes have had alliances and confederations. I think the brief description we've had of the environment at Standing Rock, the things that I've heard, you know, from people, is that this ability for people, tribes, to get together and say, oh my gosh, that happened to us here. What are you doing? That's happened to us, because people have been isolated and think that, and they've internalized a lot of this and think this is only happening to us, to find out that it's happening to each other and to generations now who can figure out some ways to start working with it. The lack of this whole thing about the reason to go to the UN, the United Nations, I think is also very important. And this concept of the covenant from nation to nation, why this has never left and why it's still important, and they're doing it for everyone. I can guarantee you that at any point of the day, anywhere in the world, there's a group of indigenous people praying for all of us and for the world. Thank you for coming very much. Thank you, Eric, Kayleen, Morningstar, Pura Case. Thank you all for being here. And thank you, SCJ.